Hello and welcome to Backchat from Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners of Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire, and to our listeners in Swindon. Hello, Swindon FM.
I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm Kay Slangandaffy.
Coming up in the show.
We have had a situation whereby war memorials are being attacked, churches are being attacked. We have had the situation now where terrorists are in power, and it seems that no amount of concessions is good enough for these people. There are ongoing attacks on our culture, there are ongoing attacks on anything which forms any sense of British identity.
The troubles flare up in Northern Ireland once again, but what's the cause this time? We speak to a protester here in Bristol.
He, with difficulty, came to the excise office on the 14th, the collection day, and got his salary. From his weak state, he was urged not to come, but he would, saying, "Once more he hoped to be able to go and draw it from me at the proper place, and I shall not soon forget his appearance and manner." Reduced and shattered as he was, in the extreme, his wit and humour remained.
Yes, Burns Night is upon us once again. Ye banks and braes. Eddie Reader there with a lovely Scottish lilt singing Ye Banks and Braes. Over now to our first studio guest, and it's Katie Finnegan-Clark from the Bristol Pound with an update on how the first citywide local currency in Europe is flourishing. So we have in the studio with us Katie Finnegan-Clark from the Bristol Pound. Katie, thank you very much for coming to join us at Backchat.
Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. So the Bristol Pound, what is it?
It's the first citywide local currency in the UK, or in Europe actually. We have basically created a pound that is supposed to complement sterling. It can only be spent in Bristol, in independent shops in Bristol. And the idea is to basically keep the money in Bristol in a very real sense, stop it from disappearing off into tax havens, into kind of mysterious pockets far away, and encourage people to think about where they're spending their money, and to encourage people to go into independent shops that they might not have thought of going into before.
So this is physical pounds?
Yeah.
Actual physical pound notes? And that's a denomination, or do they go up to £5 notes and £10 notes as well?
We have £1 note, £5 notes, 20 and 10. Yeah.
How would we recognise it?
They all have the Bristol Pound symbol on, which is a combination of a B and a pound symbol. We had an open citywide competition for the design, so they've all got interesting different designs on. £20 note has a picture drawn by a 10-year-old on. And, yeah, they've got sort of historic Bristolian images on, such as Hannah Moore, a picture of Hannah Moore, who's the famous anti-slavery campaigner.
And yeah, they physically look like the £5 notes, £10 notes that we see in circulation in England.
Yeah, they're similar. The same size, and they've got the same feel about them. They're very secure. They've got 8 security features to them, because we were kind of very wary about, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, I know what I'll do. I can copy one of those. But no, they're really very secure, with watermarks, like heat sensitive patch in the corner which disappears if you put your finger on it. And then we also have the electronic money as well, so it's not just the paper money. We have a text to pay system. It's kind of like using a card, but you use your phone to pay.
As you were saying, it's for use in Bristol.
Basically, it's to support independent shops in Bristol, drawing attention to independent shops. And we do a lot of free marketing for the independent shops who accept the Bristol Pound. But also, it's a very real, tangible way of keeping the money in Bristol and keeping the money in the independent sector in Bristol. So,
who actually acts as the bank?
Bristol Credit Union, which is based on Cheltenham Road, which is a really brilliant alternative to mainstream banks, and we're really proud to be partnered with them. Basically, if you want to open a Bristol Pound account, it's through the Bristol Credit Union, and we've worked really closely with them to create a new system of paying, and you have online banking. And James Berry, who's the head of the Bristol Credit Union, is really supportive and done so much work over the last 3 years just for the love of the Bristol Pound, basically.
It's not a setup that we could put all of our money into. Of my normal spend, I want to spend, you know, 80% of that in Bristol. Therefore, I'm going to take my budget and transfer 80% of that into Bristol Pounds. Is that really the aim that you're going for?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a complementary currency. It's not supposed to replace sterling in that way. The Bristol Community Farm is just opened a challenge today, and they're taking people's names for people who want to stop using supermarkets for a whole year. I'm going to do a big sort of campaign around that, and people are going to sign up to it, and I think they're going to support each other.
The Bristol Pound, is it based on a model that was used elsewhere?
Well, we've worked with the Brixton Pound. There are other local currencies in the UK. There's the Totnes Pound, the Brixton Pound, the Lewis Pound and the Stroud Pound. And actually, also, I saw today the tooting pound, which I've never heard of before. So someone from who helped set up the Totnes pound is very involved in the Bristol pound. We've worked with the Brixton pound to get the funding to develop the text-to-pay system. Yeah, we've just been trying to learn from the successes and mistakes of other local currencies. So we're quite confident that we've got the most robust system there's been.
And how long has it been launched for now?
Since the 19th September 2012, so...
And have there been any significant issues since the launch? Has it been quite smooth?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the major change, unexpected change, was we had to go through a whole series of meetings with the Bank of England and the FSA.
Financial Services Authority.
Yeah. And they approved the system. They weren't particularly pleased about it. They were interested and a bit weirded out. But yeah, it was approved. But then actually a week after we launched, they decided that we couldn't charge a 3% charge, basically, to turn Bristol pounds back into sterling for traders, because that was a sort of mechanism to stop traders just accepting the Bristol pounds and turning it back into sterling. They came to us and said, no, you can't do that. So that makes it easier to recruit businesses, and it's like it's risk-free for them, and they can give it a go and then, you know, see how it goes without sort of the risk of the charge. But yeah, it was a disappointment. When the FSA say you can't do something, you can't do it. So that's the end of that, really. Yeah.
So the idea about the flow of money is it goes into a Bristol pound and it stays as a Bristol pound for as long as possible then?
Yeah. But it's one of the ideas. There are so many different ways of looking at it. You know, if someone's spent a Bristol pound, it means they've actively spent their money in an independent shop in Bristol. And so there's the kind of psychology of it as well. And also, I meet up with my friends in coffee shops that accept the Bristol pound. So then they bring their business to those businesses as well. So even if they're not using the Bristol pounds, they're bringing their business to that place because of the Bristol pound.
You as a company, the Bristol pound, has the word spread throughout the UK and throughout Europe and further?
Yeah, definitely. I've actually started making a document of all the requests for information we've had from around the world, from people wanting to set up their own local currencies. So many different types of people have got in touch with us and be like, oh, this is amazing what you're doing. We're really keen. We've got a group ready. Here are some questions. I've had over 25 requests for information from all over the world, which is really exciting. Also quite time consuming.
But, I can imagine. Yeah. Well, I know on the day of the launch, I was watching Russia Today, the news channel on the television, and it was featured as one of the articles which shocked me to pieces that it would hit straight away. So have you had any other such big countries being interested?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've got China Central Television coming tomorrow, the official state television station for China. We've had Ukrainian television, Russian television. Australia, ABC have done two features on us. It's really exciting, but it's also a little bit irrelevant because it's all about making it happen in Bristol. So we're really glad that people in Australia seem to be interested. And we do actually get a lot of interest from Australia, but it's not really the point of it.
So talking about the model and talking about the Bristol pound will only be relevant when you know it's been an actual proven success.
When you're very aware that, not that the world is watching, so that's an exaggeration, but when you're aware that people are watching to see what happens, lots of people are like, oh, I'm very interested to see what will happen with that. It's like, ooh, pressure.
Well, on Backchat, we do talk to an awful lot of people who have green or eco links to what their role, their companies, that kind of thing.
Impressive. Absolutely. And I think George Ferguson taking all of his wages in Bristol pounds, I don't know if you heard about that.
So that's the Bristol mayor.
And then they just agreed tonight, I think, in council that he's going to get paid £61,000. So that's 61,000 Bristol pounds in circulation.
And how many pounds are in circulation at the moment?
We've got just over 100,000 in circulation.
So 61,000 does push it up quite a lot then.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really great. And also it brings a level of legitimacy, and because I think a lot of my work in particular is around showing people that we're not just this weird little thing, that we're not a con or a tax fraud thing. We're actually a really legitimate, we're staying here, we're going to be here, and this is real money and you can use it and it's safe. So his trust in us, and we kind of have got to know him. yeah, it's really helped us and really appreciative of that.
Is there anything else that you wanted to cover while you're here?
Well, if people want to open a Bristol Pound account, they can go down to the credit union or they can come to our sign-up lunch sessions at the Corn Exchange, in the lobby of the Corn Exchange on the top of Corn Street. And that happens every Thursday from 12 till 2:30. And if you bring along some ID and a proof of your address, you can get signed up on the spot. And we're really encouraging people to do that. I mean, if you think it's a good idea, then we need people to sign up and start using it, because lots of people think, that's that's kind of interesting, or yeah, I'm really glad that's happening, but you've got to make it happen, guys. So, yeah.
Just put your Bristol Pound where your mouth is. Really.
Yeah, exactly.
And is there a website that we can go to?
Yeah, it's bristolpound.org, and on there, there's a directory, and you can see there's over 500 businesses accepting the Bristol Pound now in Bristol. So you can see there's an interactive map with little profiles. You can discover your local bakery, and there's some really amazing businesses on there that I never knew about, and I'm from Bristol. And yeah, so it's an exciting way of finding out about new little independent shops.
Thank you very much, Katie.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
We've heard in the news recently about the troubles in Northern Ireland over the Union Jack. Some people might think for the Union Jack it's only a flag, why all the fuss? But the problem is much more deep-rooted than that. James Melia met some protesters here in Bristol, and this is what they had to say.
Joined now by Ewart Farrell and Sween, what are you doing today here in Bristol?
We're here today to show solidarity with the British citizens in Northern Ireland and the ongoing dispute about the Union flag flying from Belfast City Hall.
So are you local to Bristol yourself?
I'm actually from South Wales, although I'm originally, as you'll guess from the accent, from Northern Ireland. But we have people here from all over. We have English people here, Welsh people, Scottish, and some from Northern Ireland. And there are several people here that are from the immediate Bristol area, yeah.
So really sort of congregated from all over the local sort of surrounding area then?
Yes, I would say for the people that live here, Bristol would be the central city, the central meeting point.
And why is flying the Union flag over City Hall in Belfast important to you?
Because this issue is not just about the Union flag. This issue is much wider. Ever since 1998 and the Good Friday Agreement, we've had a situation whereby British citizens have been given concession after concession to Sinn Féin IRA. We have had a situation whereby war memorials are being attacked, churches are being attacked. We have had the situation now where terrorists are in power. And it seems that no amount of concessions is good enough for these people. There are ongoing attacks on our culture. There are ongoing attacks on anything which forms any sense of British identity. They have already decided that their next targets, Sinn Féin's next targets, will be removing the Royal from the name of the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast, and also getting any royal insignia removed from the Royal Courts of Justice in Belfast. So their agenda is clear for all to see, that it is not just about a flag, it's their intolerance and bigotry towards anything that is deemed to be British whatsoever. So this protest is not just about a flag, this is really the straw that's broken the camel's back, the flag issue. And it's the issue that has pushed us to the edge now. And we are just here today showing our support for British citizens in Northern Ireland. The one thing I would like to say about this protest is it is totally peaceful, as all these protests should be, and we totally and unreservedly condemn any violence that is associated with these protests. There are ongoing protests in Northern Ireland, the vast, vast majority of which are peaceful, but unfortunately the media will concentrate on the ones where there is violence, and we condemn the violence because it does not advance our cause in any way whatsoever. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here we have Jeremy Levitt in the studio, who's going to talk about the use of drones in warfare.
Hello.
And so how are drones used in warfare?
Well, mostly for killing people, but largely for reconnaissance. The drones we're actually using in warfare right now were originally recon variants, which we just strapped rockets to. Drones have existed for a very long time in the sense of remote control aircraft. We've had them since the First World War to use as flying targets and so on. But it's only really in the last few years that they've been very widely used as a weapon of war. And only in the last few years that they've largely come to public attention and people have started condemning them as an awful, illegal and inhumane form of warfare.
Well, do drones actually ever get targets wrong, as in they blow up civilians instead of actual targets?
Yes, but that's for human controllers. Drones don't have any real target selection of their own. There is always a human behind every attack. The idea that they're kind of autonomous weapons a la Terminator, that these are robots which are picking out exactly who to kill, is nonsensical. These are just like any other weapon. There is a human pulling the trigger. There is a human selecting the target. They're remote control planes firing guided missiles, but there is always a human in the loop there.
And seeing that there's always a human in the loop there, would you say there are any kind of benefits to having manned aeroplanes or anything?
Well, drones as we currently have them are only useful for completely unopposed ground-to-air attacks, which, as in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is fine because they're unopposed. All they really are is missile platforms. I mean, the current crop of drones are slow, light missile platforms. They couldn't fight another aeroplane. I mean, they're not even fit for air-to-air weapons at the moment. So as it currently stands, they have no chance of replacing manned aircraft in anyone's inventory. They're a very specific weapon for a very specific purpose.
And do you see in the future the use of drones increasing for various different tasks?
It does seem to be heading that way. The US Navy recently managed to land a fighter drone on one of their carriers as part of their attempting to develop a drone which you can use from carriers as a fighter. In America and in Europe, and I believe in China, the various companies are attempting to develop drones which are capable of air-to-air combat and doing all the things that manned aircraft can do at the moment. There is a lot of scepticism about this, that drones will never be able to match reflexes of human pilots because you always have this kind of loop to the operator.
Do you think it's moral for drones to be able to select targets on their own?
Entirely possible right now that we could just give a drone permission to pick out targets on its own and fire at them. There's no technical limitation. But among people who use drones, which at the moment is very largely the US Air Force, there is a very, very strong idea that you absolutely shouldn't be having a machine picking out targets on its own.
Do you think the recognition gained by drones with the computer interface will be able to correctly identify targets or not?
Well, it all comes down to correctly. I mean, setting your parameters, it's not just about looking at a target and working out what it is. As they're currently used, drones are mainly used for bombing buildings and occasionally vehicles, which house suspected militants, terrorists, whatever word you want to use, and blow up suspected terrorist training camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In a stand-up war, in kind of direct World War II-style confrontation, such as we haven't had many interesting ones since the First Gulf War, a drone which could be programmed to pick out targets like tanks or enemy aircraft, that is perfectly feasible, and I can see that happening. I imagine that drone operators will always want to keep a human in the loop. As it currently stands, it's not just morally questionable to have drones picking out their own targets. It's rather unfeasible. Target selection isn't something that you can just do from the air. There is immense amounts of intelligence which goes into it ahead of time.
Well, on that subject, are drones reliable right now? Are more civilians killed by drones at the moment than manned aircraft?
No, but that's partly a factor of how the war is being waged, if you can call it a war, partly a factor of the weapons they're using. Drones are an extremely precise form of aerial bombardment. The missiles they mainly use are Hellfire missiles, which are a form of anti-tank weapon, which has a very small focused warhead. Basically, you can use it to blow up a house without damaging the house next door. In terms of collateral damage, they are much less messy and ineffective than, say, conventional bombs, artillery strikes, or going in and invading with troops. But you always have targeting problems. You can always miss. You can always hit the house next door. You can always misidentify the target and accidentally blow up a school bus. But this is a fact with any weapon, really.
And seeing as warfare has developed over the years, and warfare in the future seems not to be open warfare, but more guerrilla warfare in a city, not out and out, like two lines of armies facing each other, do you think drones will have a bigger use in the future?
I think drones will continue to be popular for the reason they are right now, which is that they are a very politically usable weapon. There is no chance of using a drone to blow someone up and it then getting shot down and one of your pilots getting killed and your own people saying, oh, look at the cost of this war. Oh, this is terrible. They're very convenient for politicians who want a war which is simple, which is deniable, which doesn't have a chance of them risking their own lives. And they reduce the potential political costs, not necessarily the monetary costs, because drones are very expensive, although theoretically they will become cheaper than manned aircraft simply because you don't need to train pilots in the same way. I can see drones becoming much more popular precisely because they don't involve the risk of losing any of your own men, which is increasingly the greatest way of losing political capital when waging war, for the West at least.
And which countries are the main users of drones nowadays?
Currently, the Americans have pretty much a monopoly on effective military drones, and they're the only ones we know of that are currently using them in any large amount. All the great combat-proven drone systems are American. The current crop of drones which is being used are essentially just repurposed reconnaissance drones with weapons attached. But actual purpose-built combat drones are in development in various parts of the world. The Americans have several different types of stealth drones being built, including those used for air-to-air combat. In Europe, BAE Systems and EADS are developing their own form of combat drones, although none are yet in service of any air force, I believe.
I know that there's a lot of people who believe that drones are morally wrong. How do you respond to this?
There's a lot of opposition, I think, to drones entirely as a concept, which is, I think, quite foolish. I mean, there's two things, which is drones as a weapon and drones as a tool. And drones as a tool means that drones as a tool, governments can now use drones with far less repercussions against them, with far more deniability, with far more ease, really, than launching a manned bombing campaign. But drones as a weapon are really no different from any other sort of weapon. They're a more effective kind of guided weapon. And this whole mentality of blaming drones rather than examining why we're having a war entirely strikes me as really very silly. Ultimately, it doesn't matter if you kill someone with your bare hands or with a rock or with a rifle or with a guided missile or with a nuclear weapon, because they are still dead. And that we are having a war is the issue that should be being discussed. Blaming drones as a morally unconscionable weapon is odd because it accepts the lie that there is a morally conscionable weapon. It implicitly includes the idea that this old style of war, where you stand up to the enemy and it's fair and you two shoot at him and he shoots at you, is right and proper, which is itself utterly foolish. There is no real moral justification for any war, but attacking the weapon, attacking the symptom rather than the issue itself, which is war, is really rather counterproductive.
But the issue with that in war nowadays is not clearly just combatants. It's civilians which are involved in those areas as well. And the point that is killing people, whichever way they're killed. But what if it's a civilian being killed?
Honestly, fewer civilians are killed in drone bombing campaign than in any kind of ground invasion, in any other kind of manned bombing campaign. This is because, at the moment, the only real bombing campaign is by drones. This is because weapon precision, weapon control, missile guidance, so on, has improved so dramatically recently. But as a form of warfare, it is, for the person operating the drones, the most clean, precise, humane way of blowing people up.
Thank you for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thanks there to Jeremy Levitt.
Our next feature is about Robbie Burns, as across the country people are getting ready to celebrate Burns Night. This, far from being just a Scottish festival, now has a universal appeal. Isla St. Clair now sings Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my faith.
Linda Paul reads Ode to a Haggis by Robert Burns.
Fair fire on a sonsy face, great chieftain o' the puddin race, aboon them a' ye tak your place, pench, tripe or therm, weel are ye worthy of a grace as lang's my arm. The groaning trencher there ye fill, your hardies like a distant hill, ye pin wad help to mend a mill in time o' need, while throw your pores the dews distill like amber bead. His knife's his rustic labour dight, and cut you up wi' ready slight. Is it our his French ragout, or olio that wad stew a sou, or fricassee wad make her spew wi' perfect scunner? Looks down wi' sneering, scornful view on sick a dinner. Poor devil, see him o'er his trash, as feckless as a withered rash, his spindle shanks a good whiplash, his knave in it, though bloody fuel or veal to dash, oh, how unfit. But mark the rustic haggis fed, the trembling earth resounds his tread. Clapping his wally knave a blade, he'll mak it whistle, and legs and arms and heads will sned like taps o' thristle. Ye powers will mak mankind your care, and dish him out their bill of fare. Old Scotland wants nae skinking ware that jops and luggies. But if you wish a grateful pair, gear a haggis.
So if you have been wondering what Ode to a Haggis actually means, here's a translation from the Old Scots into English. Ode to a Haggis. Fair and full is your honest, jolly face, great chieftain of the sausage race. Above them all you take your place, stomach, tripe or intestines. Well are you worthy of a grace as long as my arm. The groaning trencher there you fill, your buttocks like a distant hill, your pin would help to mend a mill in time of need, while through your pores the dews distill like amber bead. His knife sees rustic labour wipe and cut you up with steady sleight, trenching your gushing entrails bright like any ditch. And then, oh, what a glorious sight, warm, steaming, rich. Is there that over his French ragout, or olio that would sicken a cow, or fricassee would make her vomit with perfect disgust, looks down with sneering, scornful view on such a dinner? Poor devil, see him over his trash, as feeble as a withered rush, his thin legs a good whiplash, his fist a nut, through bloody flood or field to dash, oh, how unfit. But mark the rustic haggis fed, the trembling earth resounds his tread. Clap in his ample fist a blade, he'll make it whistle, and legs and arms and heads will cut off like the heads of thistles. You powers who make mankind your care, and dish them out their bill of fare, old Scotland wants no watery stuff that splashes in small wooden dishes. But if you wish her grateful prayer, give her a haggis.
Robert Burns was born in Ayrshire in 1759. He was the pioneer of the Romantic movement. On the morning of the 21st of July, Robert Burns died in Dumfries at the age of 37. The funeral took place on Monday the 25th of July, 1796, the day his son Maxwell was born. His body lies in the Burns Mausoleum in St. Michael's Churchyard, Dumfries. We now go to Edinburgh to hear about his last letter from David Brown.
I'm at the National Archive of Scotland in Charlotte Square. I'm here now with David Brown. Can you tell us your role at the National Archive Museum?
Yes, I'm head of Collections Development Branch at the National Archives of Scotland, and part of our work is to catalogue the records of private and other families held by the National Archives. What we're looking at is an image taken from the Kirk Session Register of Mauchline Parish in Ayrshire, and it's Robert Burns, as we know it, acknowledging that he'd fathered twins by Jean Armour in 1786. And what we have is on the 25th of June, the Kirk Session report compeared, that is, appeared, turned up, presented himself, compeared Robert Burns and acknowledges himself the father of Jean Armour's children. And it's then they made him sign, signed Robert Burns, they made him sign it. So this is the Kirk Session. Obviously, Jean Armour and Robert Burns were not married at that stage, and of course any illegitimate children in the parish were the interest of the Kirk Session, because they might well wind up having to pay the poor's money if they had orphans on the parish. They had a vested interest in chasing down the parents of the fathers of illegitimate children, and that's what this record shows. Obviously, they married subsequently, so that would probably have pleased the Kirk Session no end.
Well, we're looking at a slide. Could you just talk
us? Yes, it's essentially the Dumfries District riding charges. It's an image of a page from the ledger, and we see that on January the 15th of 1795, Robert Burns is signing for having received from his collector, that'll be John Mitchell, £1.15 sterling as fourth round riding charges. I guess that will be his expenses for running his horse.
And I'm actually looking at a letter.
On 14 July 1796, Robert Burns visited his workplace, the excise office in Dumfries. The touching farewell that the dying poet took of colleagues is recorded in a newly discovered letter in the National Archives of Scotland. This remarkable document reveals how, despite being reduced and shattered in his final illness, Burns's lively spirit remained. During his last years, he suffered from what was probably rheumatic heart disease, complicated by bacterial endocarditis. At last, he was unable to work, and on medical advice, attempted a cure of sea bathing at Brough on Solway, near Dumfries. He went there on 3rd July 1796 and reassured his wife, Jean Armour, who was expecting her ninth child, that he was getting some benefit from bathing. He was still attempting to write songs, but his appetite had gone and he could only take porridge and milk. He told friends he felt himself to be dying. A lawyer's letter demanding payment of a debt for his volunteer's uniform caused him further distress. To ease his situation, he begged money from friends and family. The letter, dated 24th July 1796, was written by his superior officer, John Mitchell, collector of excise at Dumfries, to Robert Graham of Fintry, commissioner of excise, who had befriended Burns and found him a job in the service. It belongs to Graham's personal papers, now in the National Archives of Scotland. "Dear Sir," this is Mitchell writing to Robert Graham of Fintry, "upon my return home today, having been in the country all last week attending revenue courts, I found poor Burns was no more. He died on Thursday. The memory of so uncommonly rare a character is to be regarded at his funeral tomorrow. Having cavalry and infantry here, they are to attend, in mourning, and are volunteers to fire over his grave. He, with difficulty, came to the excise office on the 14th, the collection day, and got his salary. From his weak state, he was urged not to come, but he would, saying, 'Once more he hoped to be able to go and draw it from me at the proper place, and I shall not soon forget his appearance and manner.' Reduced and shattered as he was, in the extreme, his wit and humour remained. As one instance, some of the officers, as he thought, looking at his hat, says he, 'I believe there is no stamp in the crown,' but pleads exemption as being in quest of a crown of glory. 'To me,' he remarked, 'I'm only 36, 10 of which only I have been in the world, and in that time all I shall say, my good sir, I have not been idle. By your favours of the 20th, I am much obliged for your attention regarding Mr. Penn succeeding to the vacancy. He has long given proof of being a capable officer and has long had a footwalk, hence a preferable claim to any in this collection. I shall, by tomorrow's post, officially acquaint the Honourable Board and propose the arrangement as, in my opinion, most conducive to the interest of the revenue. Respectfully, I am, your obedient, humble servant, John Mitchell, Dumfries, Sunday, 24th July, 1796.
So I'm very pleased to meet the descendants of John Mitchell. Can you tell us a bit more about that? What's your name, please?
I'm Lindsay. This is my cousin Sally. We didn't find the letter, but we read in the newspaper that it had been found, and we were terribly excited because we've been researching our ancestry and we've always had a particular interest in John Mitchell. And we have got quite a lot of information about him, but the idea that there are new letters or there are letters around which we didn't know about is very exciting to us. It might give us even more information about our great times eight grandfather. Obviously, I think if they've come out of exchanges about excise, they're going to be much more business-like letters. I must admit, as a family researcher, we're terribly interested to know about what his wife was doing at the time and what his address was in Dumfries, and none of that is coming through. But if there's this letter, there might be others, and we'll be very interested to see if we can find more and find more out about our man.
It's quite hard sometimes to collect letters from that long ago.
It is. Luckily enough, we have some family papers, none specifically from John Mitchell, but quite a few from his daughters, which have told us a little bit about him and about the rest of the family and where they all dispersed to. he was a remarkable man in that in the space of his life, his wife had, I think, 17 children, included in which were a set of triplets and a set of twins. So I think by the time he was 12 years married, he had 14 children, which was pretty good going. So the family is very interesting, and working out where they went across the world is very interesting as well. But the one from whom we are descended came to Musselburgh, which is where we come from as well. So we didn't really travel very far from where our ancestors came from.
We bought this collection some while ago, and we were well aware that the papers of the Graham family of Fintry might well have held material about Robert Burns, and we are putting together a project with Edinburgh University to see whether or not we could raise funding to get a detailed catalogue produced. And it was part of the preparation for that that I stumbled across this letter by John Mitchell, who was Robert Burns's boss at the excise office in Dumfries. It's interesting for a number of reasons. From a narrow one, it solves a minor mystery in the public records. We have known for many, many years that Robert Burns made his last signature in his salary book to collect his salary on the 14th of July, 1796. We've never understood how he was able to do this, because all the other historical records we have show that Burns was 10 miles away at a place called Brough, down on the Solway Firth. This letter tells us for the first time that he made a penultimate visit to Dumfries on the 14th. It must have been desperately difficult for him. The letter is very clear that he was in some dire straits. He was extreme shattered, I think is the description of him. He made it, presumably in a carriage, the 10 miles to sign for his salary and collect it. And while he was there, we have this extraordinary image of him both joking with his colleagues in the excise. His fellow office workers seem to have taken exception to his hat and appear to have implied that he had not paid the stamp tax which he was supposed to pay on hats, or at least hats of a certain value. What we also see is that he turns to John Mitchell and gives what is quite clearly a knowing valedictory on his own life, saying that he's been alive 36 years and, as he puts it, 10 years in the world. We understand means, of course, that it's 10 years since he published the Kilmarnock edition of his poems. That is 10 years since he first became noticed by the general public. He then concludes by saying to John Mitchell, "I think I have not been idle," which is his valedictory, essentially, on his life and career. He would have known, I think, at that stage, or he would have been reasonably certain, that he was fatally ill. He returns to Dumfries on the 10th of July and dies 3 days later on the 21st. This letter is written on the 24th of July. So John Mitchell is, as it were, right after the fact. It's very, very near. In effect, this is the first, I suspect, official notification that the excise office in Edinburgh would have had that one of their employees, Robert Burns, was dead.
In that letter, there's a famous quotation of Burns, isn't there? "I have not been idle."
Well, it's not famous, but I think it deserves to be famous now. It is very much his valedictory. He must have known that he was dying, and it's a pretty good summation. He's had 10 years of producing his own poems, of collecting the poems and songs of others, and I think the 200 years since that have shown his idleness has not been he has not been idle.
Have you got many original documents by Burns here?
We have very few original documents by Burns himself. He was a civil servant, a public servant, working for the excise from 1789 until his death in 1796. And so his signature occurs regularly in excise records. We don't have any great body of letters or papers by him. That's just one of these things. Quite quickly after his death, Burns' correspondence and letters became collector's items. We know that his library was dispersed very quickly, and many of his letters and private papers were taken away quickly. This is why you find Burns' letters now scattered in libraries and archives and museums all over the world, and in private collections as well.
That was Anthea Page reporting from the Scottish National Archive Museum in Edinburgh. Eddie Reader now sings one of Burns' most famous and romantic songs, "My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose."
blooms like a red, red rose. It's newly sprung in June. My heart is like a melody that sweetly plays its tune. This fair art thou, my bonny lad, so deep in love am I, and I will love thee still, my dear, till all the seas gang dry, till all the seas gang dry, my dear, and the rocks melt with the sun, and I shall love thee still, my dear, though the sands of life shall run. But fare thee well, my only love, and fare thee well a while, and I will come again, my dear, though it were 10,000 miles.
The ancient Scots were tribemen, the Picts. So let's hear about them as depicted in art.
It's Leslie Reid here. I'm a Scottish artist working in Scotland with ancient Celtic art.
And can you tell us about your inspirations?
Well, it's based on the original artwork of the Picts. And that's how it started. And this is indigenous people that were here before the Scots. So I've worked for about 23 years reproducing this early artwork. It's now gone into other things like Norse and Irish images and some prehistoric. But the majority of my work is Pictish, which you find from the Fife Coast right up to Shetland. And they date from around between the 7th and 9th century. The process I use is I carve the stones. Well, first of all, I draw it onto the image onto this piece of sandstone. And then I recarve the image. I then place a piece of calico cotton on top of the stone, and then I rub it using a special coloured beeswax, which I also make. The image then comes onto the cloth. These images are then sold on my website, which you can see at www.ancientstoneart.com. You can also buy a print of the handmade originals, which look exactly the same, but what you're getting is a photographic image, including the cloth. It's not an actual cloth, it's a photograph of the cloth. But the quality is such that you wouldn't really know unless you touched it. So I can sell these a little bit cheaper.
Now, on the back of your prints, there's a little story, isn't there, to each one?
Yeah, well, I try and make the piece as individual as I can, because every one is unique. And so they do get a little individual story. Sometimes if it's an image of a goose, there isn't an awful lot to say, so I give a generalised story on the pics. But sometimes it might be more specific. For example, if it was a cross from Iona, I might we'll talk about the history of St. Columba and the O'Neills of his ancestry. So that there's sometimes they're more specific to the image.
Now, I've just bought a mug, and that was a very interesting story. Could you tell our listeners a bit about the mug story, you know, the bracelet, was
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah, yes, it was a little brooch, actually.
Could you describe it for us?
Well, it's an extraordinary little creature with an amazing hairdo, and it's got this amazing smile on the face. One hand is gripped around his throat. It's a mischievous piece, but it's about luck and about how luck will eventually give us up. And he holds all these little bangles around his wrists and arms, around his body. But, as I said, eventually, luck will give us up and we'll run out of luck. I mean, the whole idea of going to Valhalla was that you will eventually die, and hopefully in battle, so that you would go straight to heaven as a warrior.
Where did you find that image?
Well, this is actually from an illustration from one of the catalogues that I have. And it was a brooch that was found in Jutland in Denmark. And it dates to around the 9th century. But it's interesting to know that these very big warriors, these big butch warriors, were actually wearing brooches. So they had a sense of humour.
Tim Burrows is back with a soundscape called A Hole Through to the Soul of Loneliness.
Sing the broken home to the Bolnik slide. Knife was sharp, it slides over the torch stream, strung like a bow, the arrow.
That's all for Backchat this week. Features were by Anthea Page and Kirsty Paul. The studio engineer was Adrian Petrovsky. And the producer was Anthea Page.
So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And me, Kay Sangandafi.
Until next week, goodbye.